First case in our calendar is 96-1389 and 96-1390, State of Ohio versus Todd M. Schlosser, et al., Mr. Ketchner. He will not be addressing the court without filing a brief.
Your Honors, we are here on a conflict certified section of appeals, and it involves one issue, which needs clarification, and that issue is whether the state RICO statute, section 29.32, subsection A1 and A2, are strict liability statutes, or if a court of appeals suggests they have a mens rea element of recklessness incorporated in it. The state contends that this statute is, in fact, a strict liability statute, was intended to be so, and that the importation of a mental element of recklessness is incorrect for two reasons. First, it contradicts the language and the intent of section 29.32, and second, to bring in an element of recklessness, a mens rea element, into this statute will lead to anomalous results. First of all, concerning the language, concerning culpability, as the court is aware, I'm sure, section 29.01.21b states that when there is no degree of culpability specified in the statute, and that the intent is plainly indicated that the statute is to be a strict liability statute, then no culpability is required to be found guilty under that statute. If, however, the intent is not plainly indicated, then the degree of culpability is recklessness. In the present statute, the language states that no person shall
May I interrupt you just for a moment, please? Just assume for your purposes that I understand your argument about strict liability and reading this into the statute, that I've read your briefs, because my question is going to be different than what it sounds like this case is about. Didn't you indict this man on a number of other issues, credit card issues?
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, what? And you convicted him of all of those?
Yes. My
concern is that I think when the RICO statute was first passed, the whole purpose of that was to get at organized crime. And it is being expanded, and I wrote the only RICO case I think we have here. And when I went through the history of that whole thing, it seems that now we're using RICO in every place that it can possibly be applied, even though it was outside the confines of what the Congress wanted it passed RICO for. And now you're asking us to make it a strict liability statute so that almost every crime could be fit into the RICO statute and you can multiply the charges. Now, that's not an accusation, that's a question, if you believe it. Isn't that what happened here? Even if you convict him of all of these RICO things under a strict liability, doesn't his sentencing stay the same?
His sentencing does, in fact, stay the same. In this case, you know, the way that the court of fire of the trial court had put it together. However, to address your question, number one, there are only certain specific crimes under the Ohio statute that are included as predicate offenses. Now, they do include what would be considered traditional crimes, such as receiving stolen property, that sort of thing. And what Judge Grady, in his opinion, calls malus prohibitive offenses, such as the ones that Mr. Schlosser was indicted and convicted for in this particular matter. I would have to say that, given the fact that there are only certain specified predicate offenses, I don't know that you could, in fact, stretch this. And in this particular case, we are dealing with a person who is exactly the type of person that this statute is aimed at. This is a gentleman who had something like 100 phone lines, he had telemarketers marketing over numerous states, promising people credit cards and receiving fees. I mean, this was a highly organized activity.
RICO statute, or if our interpretation is that it is a strict liability statute, would you, as prosecutors, then not be charging consistently under RICO, as opposed to even the other sections of the code that might apply, simply because the penalties are greater and the offense is easier to prove?
I don't think so, and I'll say it for a number of reasons. In other words, I think what your concern is, if I'm correct, is let's say we have a small-time person who's involved in more than one, let's say, receiving stolen property. Would we charge them under RICO just to bump up this?
Yeah, we've never thought that was a RICO case before, have we?
And I think, Your Honor, even so, there is some protection here. You have to still prove a pattern of this activity. I don't think that adding the mental state will either improve the situation or get rid of the suggestion you're making. I think that we still are stuck with factually proving a pattern to the jury that this was an organization or a person involved in an enterprise, and it does say that in both of those sections, a person involved with an enterprise that engaged in an active a pattern of corrupt activity. So I think there still are elements that the state has to prove to a jury. I don't think that adding a mens rea element really does anything one way or the other.
Don't some of those cases hold, however, that a pattern is more than once?
Oh, yes.
And so twice could be a pattern on two petty theft cases.
That could be true, Your Honor. Again, let me come back to the intent of the statute, and I believe the wording of the statute. It talks about an enterprise. It doesn't talk about John Smith, individual person working by himself or loosely with friends. It talks about an enterprise. The statute is aimed at organized crime. That's the intent of the statute, and I think the wording supports that. So again, I don't think that the use of the importing of a culpable mental state will in any way affect that at all. Again,
well, doesn't
the state has to prove.
Doesn't the statute perhaps recognize it? Hasn't the legislature perhaps recognized that organized crime is something broader or well, broader than what we typically used to think of as organized crime, the mafia, and a highly sophisticated big organization, that you can have organized crime in activities such as we find here with the defendant, that there is a certainly here there was a pattern of corrupt activity, and that it seems to me that the General Assembly really intended to catch this kind of activity, although it's not what we think of in the traditional sense of organized crime. And I guess the General Assembly has authority to do that. It is a broad definition, but
I think you raised two good points, Your Honor. Number one is that, yes, when we traditionally think of organized crime, we think of the mafia. However, we are talking about organized crime. We're talking about something like Mr. Schlosser's enterprise here. And this was incredibly organized. They had phoning systems that I can't even conceive of, hunting groups, rotary groups, hundreds of phone lines, highly organized. They had scripts that telemarketers used. Now, they adopted them so that they were fraudulent. But this was a highly organized. You could not say that this was not an organized crime. So I think you're absolutely correct. And again, with the legislative intent, the definition, this is what the legislature has provided, is more than one of these offenses. But again, you still have to show some sort of organization, some sort of enterprise. And I think that is still a burden on the state. And again, to import culpable mental state won't change that at all.
And the word enterprise is not defined in the statute any place, is it?
I don't believe it's defined under, and I'm going to have to plead ignorance on this. I know it's not defined under 29.3.32. Yeah. It may be defined under 29.
It's defined under 29.3.31.
All right.
And it does include, enterprise includes any individual. And then it goes on and says sole proprietorship, partnership, limited partnership, et cetera, et cetera. So does it include an individual?
Yes, it does. However, when you go over and read the first two parts of section 29.23.32, it says any individual acting with an enterprise, and that's where that ties in. So that you can't, in other words, it isn't just aimed at an organization, it has to be aimed at sole proprietorship. committees, of course, but they are working through an enterprise, so if you read the two of them together, I think you can do it. Your honors, as Justice Douglas says, we're all familiar with how we use recklessness as not specified. However, I was looking for attention to the analysis that Judge Grady did concerning what is and what is not a justifiable offense. And I think he cites the language of the fake offenses here under the Credit Services Act. If you look at the language under the RICO statute, you'll find that it's very similar. Now, what Judge Grady does, and it's an interesting point, intellectually, I don't think it really applies here, is to say, okay, fine, the statute does say no person shall, and it doesn't specify a degree of culpability. And normally, certainly in the Credit Services Act statute, that would indicate strict liability. However, the distinction he makes, and I don't think it's with support, at least not in these statutes, is between what are traditional crimes, which he calls, in the use case, malum in se, and malprohibitive crimes, which are more regulatory in nature.
I think what gave me pause about your argument was on page 5 of your brief, the third full paragraph, you say that section 290121B, that where a statute does not specify any degree of culpability and plainly indicates a purpose to impose strict liability, then culpability is not required for a person to be guilty of the offense. And I guess that's a whole strange concept to me, that you can be guilty of something that you aren't culpable of.
Well, Your Honor, that's the words of the statute and the definition of strict liability offense, and that in a nutshell is what a strict liability offense is.
So how are we convicting somebody of something they're not culpable of?
Let me address that, because that was addressed in Haddix, and I refer the word to the Haddix decision for very well reason. In Haddix, and also in Thrower, which takes a slightly modified approach, both cases said that we are not dealing with individuals who are not culpable. In order to even get to the RICO statute, we first have to find them culpable of more than one predicate offense.
Mm-hmm.
So these are not innocent individuals who are standing before a jury or before a court and then are suddenly found guilty for something that they have no culpability of. This has been held consistent. So these are culpable individuals. The question then is, and this is going back to Judge Grady.
I've got it. Now, what you're saying is that it's not that there isn't any culpability. It is not culpability with regard strictly to this offense, but the underlying offense that brings the predicate offense to raise it to the level of a RICO offense, there is culpability.
That's correct.
I see.
That's correct.
And that's really what Haddix holds, I guess.
Isn't it? Yes, it is. And to go beyond that, Your Honor, if we look at it, and I like Judge Grady's comments about the malpractice offenses. He says that these are offenses that are aimed at the general public welfare. It's on page 39 of his opinion. And the greater the harm to the public, the more the intent would be to make this a strict liability statute. Here we have a situation, and I think this is what Judge Grady is missing from this. It is the pattern that is the threat to the general public welfare. It is the racketeering and organized pattern of these offenses that is the malum prohibitive. If we go to individual offenses, if we convict somebody of, let's say, 5 different counts of one of these predicate offenses, yes, each individual one requires culpability. They are malum in se. However, the pattern, which is what the legislature was intending to get at and what it was intending to protect the public from, is the malum prohibitive. It is the pattern that is a threat to the general public welfare. I think that Judge Grady didn't see it that way, but I think that's what we're talking about here. And interesting, too, in Haddix, the results, Haddix goes into the results of this also, and the effect of applying mandatory status helps this. What happens, and I think this case is a good example of this, is that you frustrate this legislative intent. Here we have underlying offenses that we have a failure to register as a credit services organization. Now, that is not a traditional crime. That is one that is created by positive law. If we take the Court of Appeals position, we are saying that this is a non-prohibitive crime. A person who commits dozens of these, who is culpable for committing dozens of this particular underlying offense, still cannot be convicted of the RICO statute without adding extra element of culpability, which frustrates me from the statute. And I think Katz also deals with the immediate position that was presented. I'm seeing it running out of time.
Yes, you need to sum up.
I'll sum up. Again, we can say that to the God position of the Court of Appeals would be to frustrate the intent of the statute, which is to get at the pattern of corruptive activity, which is an algorithm statute aimed at the general public welfare. And it also contradicts, I think, the plain language of the statute. You understand?
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.